It's Wednesday, January 10th, 2018. Sorry about that. This is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. As you can tell, I'm a little rusty. It's first time back after 3-4 weeks. This week on our program, we're going to be talking about the BBC's longtime China editor who quit after finding out that her pay was significantly lower than several of her male counterparts. And she's not the first woman to walk away from a job in the recent past few weeks. What's so hard about ensuring equal pay? There's a new publisher at the Columbia Daily Tribune. We'll talk about the challenges ahead for her and the reporting of those rumors that Oprah Winfrey is eyeing a run for the White House in 2020. There's a lot more, hopefully, that we'll get to as well before our half hour is up. But I want to start by talking first about Fire and Fury. The booksellers can't seem to stock fast enough, and that the Trump administration doesn't want anyone to read. By now, you've probably heard about as much about the book as you've ever wanted to, and if you're like me, maybe you've already read it. People on the right, including Trump and those surrounding him, say that it's a work of fiction. Those on the left, it's probably reading it is another act of confirmation bias. That's what has made the media circus surrounding it so interesting to watch. Let's talk about Steve Bannon and his role in it. Sunday issuing a statement that softened some of the statements that are in the book, quotes from him about Donald Jr. But he hasn't said that they weren't accurate. And yesterday, being removed from the head of Breitbart News.
I mean, he may be as big a victim of this as the president, or even bigger, at least in the short run. I mean, I don't know that him coming out with his statement, if he'd done it a little earlier, would have made any difference, but surely not doing it until later sort of sealed his fate, because you had Rebecca Mercer, you know, who was funding Breitbart partly, to basically say, I'm not giving you any money anymore, and she's distancing herself from him. But, you know, how could he deny most of the things that were said? Because one has to believe that Michael Wolff has tapes. He says he has tapes.
He says he has them, yes.
And he probably has a lot of tapes, you know, with Bannon. So he can't deny things that have been recorded.
Well, I mean, this sort of goes back to the whole issue that sort of popped up when Bannon decided, made the decision or was forced to leave the White House, that the whole loyalty thing between him and Trump was very, you know, on thin ice, almost from the beginning. They were basically using each other, and when that wasn't necessary anymore, they sort of moved away from each other, and now it's the back and forth, he said kind of thing. And Bannon, to a certain extent, by making these comments to Wolf that were published in this book, has pretty much disavowed everything that he did with Trump.
I just don't know, Amy, and this is not an original thought. Gosh, knows a lot of people have brought it up in the past week or two, but how in the world could Steve Bannon or Donald Trump or anybody in his inner circle have allowed Wolf all the access that he got, given what he's written in the past about other famous people?
So let me ask you a question about this, about that specifically, because there has been a lot of talk about Michael Wolff sometimes being a little fast and loose with the facts, that he's tabloidy in his work. And one of the things that he said was that, you know, he had these tapes and that this happened, one of the dinners that's described. Janice Min, who is one of our 2016 Missouri Honor Medalists, who at the time was at the helm of The Hollywood Reporter, said that she believes everything he was saying because she was at that dinner where these, believes what Wolf is saying because she was at that dinner where these things were said. So that's kind of led to an interesting conundrum or a thought. If you are a Steve Bannon, if you are a Roger Ailes, and you're invited to a dinner in Michael Wolff's house with a bunch of other people, how much of what you say in that dinner, do we have an expectation of privacy, or are you on the record in that case?
Well, you know, I'm looking at that, and I'm looking at this entire incident. You can call it an incident, you can call it, you know, the dinner, the meetings, the conversations. It all plays into the reality TV world that we live in, that is what's going on right now in the White House. I mean, it truly is a reality TV show, and Wolf's comments, along with Bannon's comments, along with the president coming out and saying that, all the things he said about Bannon, it all plays into that. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous that our politics has gotten to this point now.
Well, for coming back to your initial question, first of all, I mean, I don't know, in a normal setting, you'd have to say that the journalist ought to set the ground rules, mm-hmm. and they ought to be clear. If you're inviting somebody to your house for dinner and then they talk, is that off the record? Is it not? But Michael Wolff has a long track. Yeah. One of the people quoted from being at that dinner, Rupert Murdoch, was the subject of a trashing book that Michael Wolff wrote about him after he ingratiated himself with the publisher in the first place. And Murdoch is one of the people who the Trump camp, the president himself, Jared Kushner, and others talk to on a routine basis. So nobody can plead ignorance here, even if a journalistic rule or two might have been bent.
But see, that to me, that plays into the whole thing that any kind of publicity is good publicity. You invite him in, even though you know this is the kind of person he is. He has a track record of doing this. You know that he's working on a book because he told you he was working on a book. And then when the book comes out, all of a sudden you're just aghast. You're aghast at what comes out. I mean, to me, it just plays into that, you know, as long as my name is in the news, as long as my comments are getting out there, then it's working for me. Yeah.
So, Amy, you said that you had read it. I've read most.
Okay, let me be a little bit more transparent. Yeah. I didn't read it. I listened to it on Audible.
Okay.
So let someone read it to me.
But you've got the source material. Yes. I haven't bought the book, but I read every excerpt that's been published by Michael Wolff.
Which they're on the Links blog as well.
And the one that's the most interesting to me, actually, I think is probably the most relevant to our program, too, which is the one, you know, where he's talking, we're in GQ, where he's writing about the media, Trump, the media president, talking about, Kellyanne Conway and Hope Hicks and how they managed to ingratiate themselves with Trump, the whole fast fascination with the media, the president maybe thinking that he can get away with anything. He doesn't matter what reporter he brings on board because he's a true savant at manipulating the media. There's an awful lot there that's really interesting reading in that particular segment of the book, not the least of which is the fact that Wolf is also consistent, as he's been for many years, in his critique of the mainstream media. Maybe some people think he was using that to suck up to Trump. But I think he believes what he says about that, and if you read the details, he pretty much lays into the mainstream media for buying into the whole Trump narrative in the first place.
Well, and I think he's got a point there, because if you look at how much time, effort, and when I say time, I'm talking about airtime on cable news, even airtime on network news, has been spent on this.
It felt like the entire week,
right,
since
exactly.
New Year's.
When so many other things are out there, we talk about that almost every time we do a show, is there's so much going on in the country right now that really has an impact on people's everyday lives that is sort of the third or fourth story in a lot of these newscasts. And the first story is it plays into this reality TV narrative of what is Trump tweeting? What are they putting on Facebook? What is this author saying in this book? What administration official is basically being kicked out, and why this day for whatever crazy reason that comes up? That's what's the number one story, and all these other things become three and four. And he's manipulated it. He is actually doing it.
I wonder too, Amy, if you buy into this notion that Wolf writes about how Trump really relies on women. He talked about Conway and Hicks as being his White House wives. I mean, he talks about how much he leans on them because he believes that they are going to be super loyal to him, and regardless of what their true personal opinions are about his behavior. That kind of rings true anyway.
It does ring true. I can tell you, hearing the descriptions, and you talked a little bit about how in that excerpt from GQ, it gets into the relationship that he has with Hope Hicks. And when you read the full book, it really is as though he's looking at her to read everything for him, interpret it, and it's her job to spin it in a way that will make him happy to hear whatever it is that is in that messaging. And as you hear about her increased role in the administration through the course of the last year, that kind of gave me the heebie-jeebies a little bit. And the other part of it, not only the reliance on women, the reliance on people who are in their 20s in some of these very high-profile roles, if only because of the lack of life experience, given how highly elevated they are within the executive branch of our government. One of the things we're going to talk about a little bit later in the show is the use of Twitter again and the tweets about the size of the button and how Twitter is not considering that a violation of terms of service. And my first thought on that, too, is, you know, it's her role up there to be in control and working with him as he's making some of those messages and interpreting how they're being communicated or received. One of the other things I wanted to bring up really is how Trump and his private attorney, maybe through the cease and desist order, created more buzz and more demand for this book, didn't really send people away. It had that opposite effect.
And in listening to and reading about what legal scholars were saying about the cease and desist, it was a pretty weak
So it wasn't argument. Even a good one.
It was, I mean, it was almost as if we're going to put this out there as a cease and desist, but we really don't. We want you to read it, you know? So, yeah.
Well, then WikiLeaks leaking it and PDFs being shared widely.
Well, I think that cease and desist came out at a moment in time where the White House was trying to figure out any message that it could put out there in response to the book. You know, over time, you know, they got on that, well, it's fantasy, questioning some of the facts in the book, questioning the motives of the author, all of that, blaming the media as opposed to Wolf or Steve Bannon for these things. But the first reaction was, we got to say something.
Yeah. And you come out with a weak cease and desist.
Well, in the attempts to discredit the book, they took on a truly Shakespearean tone where methinks thou dost protest too much. And that was no more obvious than on State of the Union Sunday morning on CNN. White House aide Stephen Miller, described in the book by Bannon as nothing more than his taker of dictation, went on to talk to Jake Tapper. And the conversation could be described as adversarial at best. Until Tapper decided he had had enough.
The reason why I want to talk about
the president
Jake,
and the White
House. The reason why I want to talk about the president's experiences, what I've seen with him traveling to meet dozens of foreign leaders, with his incredible work.
Okay, you're not answering the questions.
No,
I understand.
You have 24 hours a day of anti-Trump material. You're not going to give 3 minutes for the American people the real experience of Donald Trump.
There's one viewer that you care about right now, and you're being obsequious.
You're being a factotum in order
to please him, okay? I think I've wasted enough of my viewers' time. As Republicans,
hey, Jake,
lawmakers call for Attorney General
about?
Jeff Sessions to resign.
Tapper returned from the commercial break that followed that tease, welcoming the audience back to planet Earth. And there were reports on the online news site Business Insider that CNN security had to forcibly remove Miller from the set. Some were applauding Jake Tapper for how he handled that. Others were saying this was TV news at its absolute worst. How would you characterize it?
You knew what you were going to get when you brought him in. I keep going back to this. Like how many times have we seen this, not just since Trump came into the White House, but even before, where you have people who are working for him, his surrogates come on and they deflect and they talk about other things, and then they start attacking the person who's interviewing him. They're attacking the networks. And then all of a sudden, the person on the reporter on the other side, or the interviewer on the other side, said, you know, I've had enough. We've got to move on. And then all of a sudden the story becomes about the incident and not the issue. And it goes back to what we talk about here all the time. The issues and the things that people really want to hear about aren't being covered because these individuals become the story. And that's what this is.
I'm so conflicted because I can see why they would bring on Miller. Because he was the closest person to Bannon.
He's kind of sort of the last man standing from that.
Yeah, and they made him available. You got to have somebody on your Sunday shows to make news. Jake Tapper is a great journalist. He's a good interviewer. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had to try to gain control of it at some point. But in the end, what's he going to do? Because Miller is not going to stop.
No, he's not going to stop.
Unless he gets cut off. And yet, at the very end of all this, my depressing conclusion of it is this. that journalists and people on the left who are disinclined towards Trump are going to say, you know, that he won, right? That
it's confirmation bias won. From the, either side.
The people who Miller cares about, well, the president, number one, as Tapper mentioned, and all of his, you know, core supporters think he won.
Right.
Well, yeah. And again, it may be that he reached that intended audience of one because Trump tweeted about how unfairly he was treated on that show and how CNN is nothing but fake news. And that was likely one of the tamest tweets from the president in the past week. I had mentioned before we were going to talk about the tweet about North Korea and the size of Trump's button. If I threatened a foreign nation or the leader of a foreign nation, it would be a violation of Twitter's terms of service, and there's a better than decent chance my tweet would be removed by the company, I would be banned from the service, and I would likely face criminal charges. Twitter says not so much, though, when you're talking about a head of state like Donald Trump or Kim Jong-un.
I mean, honestly, Twitter and Facebook, which have terms of service, they violate them all the time, or trying to apply them in many different situations is hard to do. But let's say that Trump clearly violated their terms of service. No business is going to take down, one, the president of the United States, and two, the single person who's driving the most traffic to perhaps prop them up and maybe cause their business model to someday succeed. And frankly, I don't think they should take him down. If the president of the United States wants to say what he wants to say on Twitter, great, let's just cover it. I mean, the antidote for bad speech is more speech, not censorship.
Well, you know, Trump is the best thing to happen to Twitter in forever.
Twitter.
In Twitter's history. Yeah. No,
right.
You're absolutely
like,
right.
I mean, 10, 12 years of Twitter.
You know, the whole, you know, service interruption, we're going to take him down, we're going to do this. That's not going to happen because he's making them money. I mean, I think the people at Twitter wake up every morning going like, what did he do today that's going to drive our stock prices?
But I mean, do you want Twitter really to take down the president of the United States
account? No. But I think that their excuse is lame. It's like, you know, what he says is important enough and people really need to hear it. I'm going like, really? That's what you're going to go with? I mean, come on, just say, hey, look, he's the president of the United States. He's the leader of North Korea. You can't make this stuff up.
No, yes,
this is
you can.
Better than any television script you could imagine, mm-hmm. and we are going to stick with this.
Okay, well, so right after the button tweet, Trump promised in another that he was going to have a very special award ceremony this past Monday night, the Fake News Awards. I'm not going to lie. I was hoping we'd be able to talk about those this week to see who the big winners and losers were. But nope, it seems those are going to be on hold until next week. Maybe because he didn't quite expect the reaction from the journalism world that he got. Like Colbert and Trevor Noah, they started campaigning.
Hey, all we need is another award show, but this one would have been great. If he'd actually pulled it off, it would have been
great.
Well,
there's a chance it's going to be next week. Now we're hearing the 17th.
You can't predict the news cycle from, you know, 1 hour to the next with this administration, let alone a week. So he may never do it. Right. If he does, we'll get a lot of laughs out of it, and the late night hosts will laugh about it. On the other hand, it's just one more opportunity for the president to ram home his message about the fake news media.
Right.
I don't think we should applaud it, you know, just even if we think it's hilarious.
Well, you know, I think we might get it. And here's why I think we might get it. Because 9 days from now.
But when you say we might get it, like Views of the News
no,
is going to get a Trump award?
Like
the world will get the Trump fake news
I think
news
the
award.
World.
Okay, I just want to make sure we were clear.
The world will get the Trump.
Just wanted to be clear. We'll
get the fake news awards because 9 days from now, the government could be shut down. Because that is the deadline. They have to come up with some sort of agreement. And right now, you've got DACA on the table, you've got border security on the table, you know, you still got Democrats who are upset about what the tax cuts mm-hmm. are going to bring. You've got all that going on. So, hey, this is classic Trump. He could throw up the fake news awards, and we'll be talking about that instead of talking about the fact that the government is gone dark.
Hey, 2 weeks from right now, the three of us will be sitting at this table talking about the State of the Union, too, and what he laid out there and what may or may not come of that, too.
Okay, this is going to be my naive statement for 2018, but is it possible that the media, if there's a new Mueller indictment or there's some agreement on immigration or the government is shut down, that we might not report about the fake news awards?
I stopped trying to make predictions after last year.
Okay. Well, Ernest, you had said we already have enough awards shows. Well, Sunday night was a pretty big one. It was the Golden Globes, and it was the first major awards show since the start of the Me Too movement. And with it, we saw the parades of stars wearing their black gowns and their tuxedos, the Time's Up pins. Host Seth Meyers made his jokes about Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey. But by the end of the night, all anyone was really talking about was Oprah Winfrey and the speech that she made.
And it is not lost on me that at this moment, there are some little girls watching as I become the first black woman to be given the same award. What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. So I want tonight to express gratitude to all the women who have endured years of abuse and assault because they, like my mother, had children to feed and bills to pay and dreams to pursue.
It was inspiring. It was riveting. It was a really good speech. How did we get, as a news media led by CNN, by NBC, how did we get from that speech to a run for president? Well, Ernest is making the face.
I
to our radio audience, Ernest is making the face.
I think that, you know, the left is looking for a leader. The left and Democrats are looking for a leader. And right now, from the political side, there really isn't anyone who they feel comfortable in standing up to that. And that speech sort of spoke to all the things that they were talking about and or what the Democrats have been talking about since the election. And they took that speech from there to go, wait a minute, maybe we can pull off the same thing that the Republicans pulled off by having an Oprah to match up against the Donald.
But the Oprah against the Donald, in my prediction, takes us right back down that rabbit hole of the DACA and the government shutdown and the third and fourth and fifth stories that get pushed out in the newscast. It's just coming from the left instead of from the right.
I didn't say it was a good plan. I'm just saying this is what I'm seeing.
Okay.
You know, I mean, one, it's crack cocaine for the news media. Oprah, oh, president,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it was a good speech. But I wouldn't and her surrogates are kind of sort of moving the story forward a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, let's be serious. Anything's possible. And Oprah Winfrey might be a fabulous candidate for president. Not because she's got the right policies or because she's an entertainer. She has a message, and she's had a message for years and years and years of empowering people. It's kind of like she could be the Democrats' Reagan, the shining city on the hill.
Okay,
all
but
these
Reagan, again, to come back to some of the stories and columns and blogs that you saw on the day two and day three after the Golden Globes, Reagan was a governor of California first. Maybe Oprah Winfrey could be a really good president, but what about congresswoman or senator or governor of some state, she has property in several, of some state before going straight for the White House?
Do you want to win?
Okay, well, fair enough. So a lot of the women's acceptance speeches on Sunday, they focused on creating a safer environment for women. And it's no secret to women, and probably more than women, that we tend to be paid less than our male co-workers who do the same work. Well, some of us aren't standing for it anymore. Take Carrie Grace, Gracie. She is the 30-year veteran of the BBC and was the China editor for the corporation. And she gave up her position running that desk after finding out that two of the other foreign editors, males, were getting paid 50% more than she and her other female counterpart. This kind of happened because the BBC made salary information public, and she was able to do the math and see things weren't working out.
Well, they were forced to make the numbers public.
Yeah.
And the thing here is that she makes a very good point. She's not comparing apples and oranges. The very same job title that she and another woman had, two men had, and they were making a whole lot more money than her. This really resonates partly because the BBC has a reputation as one of the leading news organizations in the world. And if you're not a reward merit for doing the same kind of work, that really hurts their reputation.
Now, she has moved into a different position at the BBC, put that up against Kat Sadler, who quit her job entirely from E! Entertainment News, where she found out that her co-host was making significantly more than she was. We hear now that Savannah Guthrie and Hoda Kotb, the two co-hosts of the Today Show, combined making less than Matt Lauer made in that position. And there was a story I added to our links blog this morning that Mark Wahlberg, in the shooting of scenes, reshooting of the scenes to replace Kevin Spacey from the movie, I believe, All the Money. That he made something like $1.5 million, while his female co-star made less than $1,000 for the reshoots, Michelle Williams.
The thing for me is that all of these examples are real examples of the problem, but they're also primarily about people who are in the public eye, and especially people who are entertainers as much as anything else. And I don't know that that resonates as much as, when are we going to deal with the practical realities of pay inequity for women who don't work in these areas of celebrity, where you can always blame the disparity on some other factor than just gender?
Yeah, this has been, this pay inequity issue has been going on for a generation. And we just have not dealt with it. And it's something that we really do need to deal with.
Okay, we have about 2 minutes left. I want to touch quickly on some changes going on at the Columbia Daily Tribune. We had talked a few weeks ago about a column asking readers to be patient as the paper undergoes some structural changes. Well, another change announced. Gatehouse execs have a new publisher. Unlike some of the other fresh blood brought into the paper since the Gatehouse purchase, she has a bit more of a mid-Missouri background and presence.
Yeah, she's worked in Jeff City. She's worked with some of the other local newspapers or small community newspapers around the state. But she's still working for Gatehouse. And I think this is sort of them trying to do more, mm-hmm. them trying to reach back into the community and build up what they've lost. I don't know if it's going to work.
My concern is that she couldn't be any less sympathetic than the person she's replacing, who was basically blaming all the problems on the readers. Just keep spending your money until we can eventually give you something that's worth spending your money on. If Gatehouse may or not make a difference, she talks about trying to engage readers more. But if the solution, as quoted in one of their own articles, is we're going to do more community events or we're going to have prep school sports awards, I don't think that's enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the talk shows tab on kbia.org, under programs as well. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.